Hey, here comes another edition of Talking Fußball, the Bundesliga show, your source for all things German football. I'm your host, Matt Herman, and this week we're taking a closer look at this week's earthquake in the Bundesliga. And by earthquake, I mean Urs Fischer's departure from Union Berlin. Truly the end of an era. With me, as so often, are Terry DeFellin. Hello, Terry.
Hi, Matt. How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good, I'd say. We've also got Nick Wildhagen in the house.
Hi there, and I assume it's a great day to be a Hertha fan today, isn't it?
Oh, we aren't even going to go there, Nick. We're trying to keep that sort of angle out of this. We're not even in the same league as those guys these days. Come on.
True, true.
Well, not this season anyway.
For the time being, yes, indeed. Yeah, we're going to be back in just a moment with all the foosball that's fit to talk. But remember, you can get in touch with us anytime you want by sending us an email, podcast@talkingfoosball.com. We also appreciate good reviews on Apple Podcasts. And if you really want to help us keep the show afloat, support us on Patreon. We got lots of great timeless content over there that will take you through all six decades of Bundesliga history. All right, here comes part one of Talking Fußball, the part where we hit up the main topic of the week. This week it's, Union Berlin, right? I feel like if there's really been a constant in the Bundesliga over the last few years, I mean, other than the obvious one, which sits at the top of the table every May for the past 11 years, the constant has been the steady rise of Erste FC Union Berlin. They were promoted in the summer of 2019, and they've climbed the table every single year since then. They were 11th their first top flight season. Then they were 7th the next, 5th the year after that. And of course, last season finished in 4th place. That got them into the Champions League. Zippity-doo-doo-doo. This season has been different, though. It's been actually kind of a shit sandwich, to put things delicately. Union, great start to the season. They won the cup. They've won their first two league matches. And that's kind of the end of the wins. They have not won a single game since then. They have not won since August. It's about Thanksgiving time here, folks, for you other country people. That's towards the end of November. I don't care who you are. Yeah?
We know what Matt is thankful for this season. sort of astonishing because, you know, we said that, Union Berlin, where are they going next? I mean, they're rising steadily and steadily and steadily. And what's next? Now they're in the Champions League. Maybe, just maybe, they might be building, you know, a serious championship contender in that forest of Berlin were, you know, some of the more outlandish remarks that were made after they reached the Champions League. And, well, as it turns out, after winning the first two matches of this Bundesliga season and sitting at the top of the table after two match days, they haven't won a single match. And, I mean, some of it has been down to not being fortunate in some circumstances. I mean, if you look at their XG stats, they are actually not rock bottom in terms of XG points. I think at least four or five teams behind them. But on the other hand side, if you look at their XG stats from last season, they outperformed them by 20 points. Getting 20 points more than you were supposed to. I mean, they were supposed to end up on something like 43 points. I mean, which is mid-table, pretty much. And they ended up in the Champions League. Which might just show that last season was sort of an outlier as well, because they were overperforming in terms of what, you know, they were very, very lucky. And this season, on the other hand side, they're very, very unlucky.
Yeah. I think regression to the mean probably explains a fair bit of all this. But I guess I want to get us back to the sort of more recent circumstances, which is getting rid of Urs Fischer. Because in my book, like at most clubs, this would have happened a good while ago. I mean, they waited until they literally went 2.5 months without a win to pull the trigger, or, you know, not pull the trigger, as the case may be, you know, leaving by mutual consent and all that. I know that if you lead a team out of the second division and into the Champions League, you've earned yourself a lot of credit. But I still find that pretty amazing that things went that way. I don't know, Nick, Terry, I don't know who wants to talk about this, but how did it all go down in terms of, I can't even use the usual cliches about the axe falling or the pink slip or any of the ways we often describe these moments for coaches being shown the door.
Well, what is this about trees falling in the forest? I don't know. Maybe that doesn't work. There is certainly someone there to hear it, so it definitely makes a sound. Obviously, it looks like there's a very, very healthy fan culture and culture around that club, it would appear. And part of that is a tremendous amount of patience in people in general, I think, and Urs Fischer in particular. And I think that I suspect that many Union fans perceive themselves as being different to other club fans. And so therefore, loyalty and patience is a virtue that they wish to cultivate. And we saw that a few weeks ago, didn't we, when some of the ultras unfurled a banner in support of Urs Fischer. And I think that was the week after the cup exit. So I think that there's a big part of that. I think there's a strong desire to try and, you know, do things differently, to not panic and to wait until really you don't think you can wait anymore. And maybe, I suppose, more cynically, they might have thought, well, look, you know what, let's give this guy until the last international break of the year. We still got a few weeks before the transfer window. There's still plenty of time left in the season and there's plenty of rubbish teams in the bottom end of the Bundesliga. We can turn this around. So that's the more practical side of things as well. You would feel with the players that they have that under a different voice, Union will start climbing the table fairly quickly.
I mean, that's what Urs Fischer said as well after he was let go or left on his own part. He said that at this point, it might do the team a world of good to, you know, have another phase and another voice telling them some other things and that this might actually change the projector of where Union's season is heading. I mean, we all know about the new coach bounce and all that, and we know that there's enough quality in that side to, you know, outdo the Darmstadts and, you know, some of the other teams in the league. But what we might also realize is the fact that it might be a long time before we see Union Berlin in the Champions League again. You know, I mean, that steady rise, it might have come to an end, and now it's sort of a reality check of where are we at in terms of, you know, playing with the big boys. Because in terms of the money that Union have on their hands, you know, they're not able to compete with Bayern, Leipzig, Bayer Leverkusen, Wolfsburg, Borussia Dortmund, VfB Stuttgart, a number of teams, a whole host of teams they are not able to compete against. And in the end, money always wins you, you know, seasons, games, and titles. And Union Berlin is never going to compete in that league with the biggest boys of the league. And they might find their place and, you know, turn out to be another Augsburg in the end.
Right. Just to further set the table about where things stand at this club as they move forward, at least for the time being, their under-19s coach, Marco Grütter, is taking over. He's bringing in one holdover from Urs Fischer's staff in Sebastian Bönig, as well as his own assistant from the U19s, one Marie-Louise Eta. That is, in fact, the first female assistant coach in the Erste Bundesliga, which I think can only be a welcome development. Yeah, enough from us. If you know our podcast, you know that we do have a person who we do turn to for all things Union. That is Kit Holden. He covers them for the Berlin newspaper Tagesspiegel, as well as is a supporter of the club too, and has been for many years. We haven't had our usual Berlin Derby appointments this season, so it has been a while since he's been on, but now definitely felt like the right time. So I called him up. I found him on vacation in Spain and asked him when during the team's recent dreadful run was the moment that he began to think, this isn't just a dip in form. Something is really wrong here.
So I think there are probably two moments, and they kind of, you know, it got worse and worse as these things do. But the first one where I thought, okay, no, this is a bit more serious than I perhaps anticipated was the Heidenheim game. Because until then, you know, you look at I think that was the fifth or sixth game maybe in the run. And, you know, of those games, you'd had Leipzig and you'd had Real Madrid and you know, and it was sort of, and the Braga game was unlucky and was the, I think it was just up behind him and Dashi. But, you know, it was sort of, you're talking away to Wolfsburg in a game they might have won or got a draw and, you know, two brilliant goals from Wolfsburg. And you kind of thought, okay, you can kind of explain all this away with the two injuries, Knochen and Khedira. And to a large extent, I think you can in some ways explain it away with those things. I think it's a weird situation where, you know, a lot of what has gone wrong has just been kind of a domino effect of things piling on top of each other. And at a certain point, it just gets into players' heads. And then, you know, even if there wasn't something fundamentally wrong, by the time you've lost 10 in a row, there is, because you have to get, you know, psychologically get out of it. And so that was the second point after the Heidenheim game, was the Bremen game. Because before the Bremen game, I was thinking, this is the one, right? If they can't beat Bremen away, if, you know, psychologically, because that's a psychological fight, and tactically, what Union were doing, the way they were playing in certain games, they were obviously still a good enough team to beat Bremen away, this Bremen side. And if they broke down in that game and you know, had a meltdown in that game, then that meant the psychology was really, really bad. And that's exactly what happened. And at that point, that's when I started to think, you know, I didn't think they would do it until Christmas, but yeah, it was that point when you start to think, okay, for all the very normal reasons why this run started, it's now got way beyond any of that. It's become just a thing of it's in their heads and they need to get it out of their heads some way.
Yeah, you mentioned that it sort of seemed like the writing was on the wall, that the relationship between this club, this team, and its coach, Urs Fischer, who had just led them to so much success, more success than anyone had ever had in the past, that it had to end at a certain point. And, you know, Dirk Tinkler was really, really, he bent over backwards to say that this wasn't a sacking, it wasn't a resignation, it was sort of a mutual consent situation, which very often sounds like, you know, BS, but this time sounded pretty real. And even since it happened, has felt real in that you keep hearing expressions of regret from both sides about the situation, and expressions of like, you know, I wish this team all the best and I wish this coach all the best in the future. And was there another way out of this, considering just the overwhelming goodwill that exists between the two parties? Or do you also agree that this had to come to an end?
I think, I mean, to be honest, I agree with you that I buy quite a lot of what Tingler said at the press conference, in the sense that, you know, I do think that's probably how they ran it. That, you know, he said to Fischer, you have my unreserved backing until you feel, you know, you've lost control of the situation, basically. But as soon as you feel that, then you have to tell me, and then we make the decision mutually. And Fischer appears to have made that call, you know, in a very Fischer way, pragmatically, at the start of an international break. So they've got 2 weeks to readjust and soak it all up. And perhaps more importantly, ahead of a period of the season, which is going to be absolutely crucial, because, you know, with Fischer or without Fischer, if you beat Braga coming back from the international break, even 1-0, you know, playing terribly, then you're into the Europa League. And if you then win, you know, two of the four games against Augsburg, Gladbach, Köln, Bochum, you're out of the relegation zone and the whole season looks completely different. But if you win one of those games or none of those games, then, you know, in a supposedly easy period of the fixture list, you've navigated it and you're still in the relegation zone. And if you lose to Braga, then you're completely out of Europe. And then at Christmas, your season just looks like a complete train wreck. And I think Fischer's logic was probably, you know, I'm not convinced anymore that I'm the man to, as I say, get this thing out of the players' heads. And it's better that at this juncture, they get the new coach boost, which, you know, tends to happen because, you know, if you get it for the next five games, those can be very crucial games to have that boost for the rest of the season. Whereas if you were to resign in January, then, you know, you've got, it's a slightly different situation because you're much deeper into the mess and you've got a few tougher games, you know, like Leipzig or whatever in the start of the Rückrunde. So yeah, I think it was a calculated decision to that extent from Fischer, that, you know, a coming together of a conflagration of factors and considerations, that this was the right moment. And yeah, hats off to him for that. But yeah, I agree with you that I don't think, I've seen a few people sort of writing, oh, it was rubbish, and it shows that, you know, Singler's 2 weeks ago when he wrote in the programme that, you know, the Fish had his full backing, you know, it shows that was all rubbish and Union are just, you know, like any other club. And, you know, I'm wary of saying Union are really special and totally different from any other club. But at the same time, I think in this particular question, they have acted slightly differently to the way most clubs in the Bundesliga would, and I do buy it. And I think you only need to look at, I mean, Marcus Hoffmann, Fischer's assistant, is a man with a poker face to end all poker faces, and the poker face that could, you know, like kill a Minotaur at 20 paces. I mean, he's a terrifying rock of a man, and, you know, he's got tears in his eyes when he's being interviewed by the club TV the other day, and, you know, when they departures and stuff, they're not actors like that, Fischer and Hoffmann. They, you know, that relationship was real, I think, but I think the decision was a measured pragmatic one from, it seems to be, you know, that was the funny thing about Singler is he said, oh, you know, we haven't sacked Urs Fischer and Urs Fischer hasn't resigned because Urs Fischer isn't the sort of person to resign. But then he basically said, but Urs Fischer decided when to go. So Urs Fischer did resign, but, you know, I mean, that's, you know, in the best way possible, I guess, to say.
Huh. It's interesting you're bringing in, you know, Urs Fischer and Michael Hofmann's, you know, personalities into this. And I think it's ultimately when you have a really long relationship between a coach and a club, a coach and a group of players, a coach and, you know, club executives, some of that actually does sort of make a difference when it comes to sort of getting into these ruts or getting out of them. I mean, obviously, Unión are a club that's famous for, you know, not only sort of punching above its weight, but also sort of remaking itself very frequently. I mean, just on the playing squad level, I mean, this is one of the teams that's always most active on the transfer market, always turning its squad over year on year, which, you know, for the most part has really worked great for this team, both sort of on the pitch and off of it. They seem to have found players for the most part in past years who learn to love this club and understand what it's about. Do you think that there might be anything to the way that this club has changed to meet the current challenge, which is the Champions League, that caused them to sort of lose their way in that process? Or am I just totally digging in the wrong place for like what might have gone wrong this year? Maybe it's nothing to do with the difference in the squad or the personalities, but it's something else. I don't know. I just wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. I don't know. I'm not inside the dressing room enough to make a real judgment call on, say, you know, what the effect on the makeup of the and the atmosphere in the dressing room is of having a player like Leonardo Bonucci, who presumably, with a lot of conjecture, is on, you know, significantly higher wages than, say, Benedikt Hollerbach, who's come from the third division. And, you know, that's a new situation for Unión if that's the case. And so that could have an effect. But I would argue as well, I think that's part of the sadness about Fischer, is that there is a real sense that actually it's not really his fault so much. And if there's, you know, to a certain extent, you know, you can perhaps point the finger even a little bit more at Oliver Runert for the fact that the squad is a little bit lopsided at this stage, and particularly in attack. You know, it just seems to be, as soon as Kevin Behrens fell out of form and you know, was no longer firing on all cylinders, then there was so much pressure and expectation heaped onto a player like Sherelle Becker, because otherwise it was, you know, Kaufmann and Hollerbach aren't good enough for the Bundesliga, really. And I think that's shown in the first few months. At least not at this point. They might become so in the coming months. But at this point, they're not, you know, decisive players. And Fofana, who is obviously, you know, unbelievably talented, but still quite raw young player. And that has been a problem, because part of the big thing is that they just haven't been able to score goals, and they haven't been able to create enough meaningful chances to score goals and snatch results. And that's the big difference, really. But I think basically the root cause of all of it is that previously, when you've had these turnovers, they've always been able to integrate players very, very quickly and make players into very integral leaders on the, you know, in the dressing room very quickly, because you've had this core in whichever, you know, side of the transition is, you always have this kind of core of leading players who are able to sort of act as a centrifugal force to drive that integration. And in this particular transition, they just had the rebound that basically could not the fundamental part of that call got injured at a point in the season where A, you had a lot of really difficult games coming up, B, that meant players like Bonucci and Tussauds were thrown into the mix before they were already fully fit and before they were fully integrated. And that kind of, again, it's that domino effect when all these factors coming together, then nothing's really working, and the kind of quick integration that you've had in previous years just isn't there. And then a few weeks down the line, suddenly that's a 7-game run without a win, and then it's the psychology that kicks in, and that's difficult. And then the fact that the squad is, you know, perhaps not quite as well balanced as it has been in previous years is much more of a problem. That said, to be fair on Oliver Runert, the day after the last day of last season, when we were just going into the Champions League, he, you know, they'd give a end of season press conference, always him and the coach and Singler. And the first thing he said that day was, this is going to be the hardest, by far and away, the hardest summer we've ever had in the transfer market, because the game has changed. You know, we're in the Champions League. We're playing on a different level now, and that means a hell of a lot more is going to have to be decided in the last week of August, whereas in the past, they've always managed to get the bulk of the squad together by mid-July. And so it transpired, and I would imagine he's not entirely happy with the squad he put together, but he knew and he was very open about the fact that it was going to be much, much more difficult. And I think, yeah, that has shown to a certain extent.
At least for the time being, it looks like interim coach Marco Grote is taking over, along with a couple of assistants, including, you know, the Bundesliga's first woman assistant coach, which there's been a lot of stories about that. I think that's obviously something we should all welcome, but I'm not entirely convinced that that crew is going to be in charge for all that long. Where do you see Union going from here? Do you see them at least going to the winter break with an interim? Do you see them trying to sort of make another significant move, either on the coaching market or the player transfer market, to sort of propel them forward and out of this problem? Or is this going to be more of a retrenchment move that we see for the next few months?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think in terms of the players and then the playing squad in the winter transfer market, I think Singer has already hinted that they will be looking at that. And I would be very surprised if they don't look particularly in attack to bring some other element in, whether that's a big name signing or, you know, a couple of different types of player who are, you know, can maybe just add another dimension, another few options to the squad. He talked about players who, you know, seeing who was ready to take on the relegation fight. And I think there's potentially a couple of players, particularly in that attack, who maybe haven't looked like they're doing that so much. And, you know, for whatever reason, they haven't been able to integrate and kind of show that they're, you know, really throwing themselves into that fight. And so, yeah, I think possibly there'll be a bit of a change to the, particularly in attack, in terms of the playing personnel. In terms of the coach question, I wouldn't be surprised if they keep the interim for as long as possible, to be honest. I mean, I think there are various options that, you know, have been talked about a lot in the last few days. And Stefan Baumgart is obviously, you know, the big name because he's had his Union history and, you know, he still has his house in Köpenick and, you know, is a club member and a club legend. I think if Köln were to decide he was no longer the right man for them, then I think I wouldn't be surprised if Union very, very quickly. I struggle to see Union trying to poach him and properly, you know, tap him up in, you know, as long as he's at Köln, because I feel like they will make the calculation that that's not worth the bad press and the general bad blood around that. But, you know, I think possibly what happens with him at Köln will be quite decisive for what happens at Union in the next few weeks. But on the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised if they go for something completely out there and something that none of us can foresee, because that's quite often their way of bringing up and saying that, you know, Fisher was an example of that. Nobody would have said before he came, oh, he's definitely the man for Union. He was a bit of a left field choice, and everyone's like, okay, well, let's see how this goes. And he was perfect. And I think that's quite often, particularly the room that way, to say, okay, now I'm going to, you know, really work on what are the criteria that I want from this striker or this defender or this coach, and then find the person who's on the market rather than looking at the market and saying, oh, who's the best of this bunch? Then, you know, should I get Oliver Glasner? You know, everybody knows Oliver Glasner. We'll get him. Maybe it will be Oliver Glasner, but that, to me, that seems to be more of a, you know, he's a German-speaking coach who doesn't have a job, so I'm not going to be interested. And I struggle a little bit more to see anyone going in that direction than something completely wild. And I think they probably will take their time, because at the end of the day, you hope that the change in personnel boosts you through the next few games, but ultimately it's about getting, yeah, two wins at least before Christmas and keeping your head just about that to properly recalibrate them.
All right. Great, great stuff from Kit Holden there. Stirring the pot a little bit about Union's coaching future. Seems to think that Grote could be around for a while, unless a certain flat cap legend happens to be out of work in the near future. What do you make of Union's coaching future, Nick?
I mean, it's funny, you know, that you should mention, you know, the six pants guy, because he actually talked about Union Berlin in one of his later press conferences, when I think he was asked about something or other, one of those, you know, idiots on Sky had said, I think it was Didi Hamann. And, you know, he led off his comment by saying, I do have a lot more insight into Union Berlin than a lot of people realize. It was his first sentence when he talked about what Didi Hamann once again had, you know, spewed out of his mouth, not knowing anything in particular, as always. But that sentence in itself is telling, isn't it? I mean, Union Berlin is written in his future. At some point, he will be their coach. But I don't think that he's going to leave Cologne voluntarily, because it really identifies with that club as well.
Terry, do you think that this is a job that, you know, either Steffen Baumgart or anyone else who has something of a track record of success? I guess the other name that Kit brought up was Oliver Glasner as being maybe a fit and maybe not. Are people going to look at this as a relegation battle job or a, ooh, this is a Champions League level club job? I mean, is it a plum or is it more of a prune?
I think you have to go with prune, unfortunately. It is alarming, and it's an example of what happens when you are a traditionally small club, and even a non-traditionally small club, as Nick's illustrated in terms of the finances. To have got into the Champions League was amazing, but because of how the season has gone down so far for Union, you know, they've started the season as a Champions League club, and now they're just a small club, you know, in a district of Berlin that's bottom of the table and is now struggling to stay in this league. And I think as a coach, and when you're looking to hire a coach, that's who you've got to hire. And Baumgart is ideal, I would suggest, for that role, assuming that he is ready to make the emotional transition should he be fired from Cologne and then go into Union. This might not be the right time for him. But also, there's been some quite high-profile names that have come into that squad. I mean, I think you immediately think about Bonucci. But also Fofana, the young lad from Chelsea, who is highly rated. But as we I'm sure remember, there was that game against Napoli in the Olympiastadion in which he insulted the coach when Urs Fischer substituted him, which may or may not have been symbolic. But the dynamic in the dressing room may have changed. And so there will be contrasting expectations going on in that dressing room, and that may prove to be quite difficult. And then if this guy, you know, this East German guy walks in, you know, and starts, you know, giving it the flat cap, you know, and keeping it real, you know, how are they going to perceive him? I mean, especially the guys from outside who don't know the Bundesliga, don't understand Baumgart and his ways, maybe don't get the culture. And how are they going to perceive that? I'm implying, or you could infer from that, that I think that maybe Baumgart is some kind of dinosaur or something like that. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just worried about how he is perceived by, shall we say, some of the squad members who may regard themselves as being somewhat more urbane. And I think that that's an issue that they have to look at in the future. So they do have to tread very carefully. In summary, I don't think that Baumgart would be the right coach at this point in Union's story. I think he would come under different circumstances and possibly walk into a troubled dressing room.
Yeah, I mean, you could imagine Christian Bonucci, like, you know, meeting Steffen Baumgart for the first time and thinking, oh, what has just happened?
Who was that guy? No, that was your boss. Yeah. Something's wrong with the translator. I asked who that guy was.
All right, so while we wait for, I'm going to use the cliche this time, the axe to fall on Steffen Baumgart at Cologne, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. All right, here comes part two of Talking Fußball, the part where we talk about the things that aren't the main topic of the week. And I think where I want to start is with maybe Terry's team, Borussia Dortmund. I think we're all pretty well acquainted with some of the negative dynamics that surround this club, its fan culture, the discourse around Dortmund being an underachieving club or a club that hasn't really found its way in some time. And, you know, after last season's almost championship, I guess there was maybe some sentiment that things were ready to change, but maybe they haven't. I mean, we saw them hang with the league leaders, at least within touching distance, for a good number of weeks this season. But I think the last two match days may have changed the narrative, and may have changed the narrative in a substantive way, not just in the usual the sky is falling sort of way. Getting absolutely whipped in the Klassiker at home is a pretty bad thing, but it's been known to happen, I understand. The subsequent performance, however, away to Stuttgart, in which a game that they were in all the way until the end, at least on the score line, I don't think was really indicative of how that game went. A 2-1 loss that kind of felt more like a 5-1 loss. Terry, what is your sort of level of negativity at the moment, and how much of that do you come by honestly?
I don't think that there's any doubt that Dortmund have not been performing to their best when you look at the players that they have and that they have signed. And I think that you can say that about Dortmund since, I want to say, something like maybe 5-6 games from the end of last season. You can put that down to just the sheer nerves and the anxieties that come when you're pushing for the title at the end of the season. And all the best clubs that win titles, certainly for the first time in a long time, will go through that period of time. It doesn't necessarily mean you're rubbish. It just means you're under a lot of pressure. I mean, you haven't really seen, I think, any kind of improvement on the field of play. They've always looked a little bit too disjointed. That said, I think there's been some unkindness around some of the online fandom about Edin Terzic and about the team. And I don't think that it's quite as grim as it is portrayed. We were talking earlier about XG points. And you'd have to say that, you know, Dortmund are, I think, where they're supposed to be in terms of their performance, which is about fifth. That's obviously not good enough for a lot of Dortmund fans. And I get that, and I get why that would be the case. And it isn't good enough, given the standards that they've set. But it is equally not terrible. I would also just like to factor in the Champions League. Beyond the pretty disastrous performance and result against PSG, Dortmund have been more than decent in the Champions League. And they pulled Newcastle's pants down in between the Clasica and the Stuttgart game. They pulled Newcastle's pants down, which was tremendous fun to watch, and put in a professional and disciplined Champions League performance. I think a lot of this, what you can be boiled down to, is that Dortmund, I think, are really struggling to field two teams a week. And I don't think they should be struggling to field two teams a week, but they are. But there's no hiding from some of the performances and some of the results. You're absolutely right about that Stuttgart result. That was a 4-1 game that ended 2-1. The Eintracht game was brilliant, but I mean, really too chaotic. We talked about this the last time, but I think too chaotic for Dortmund. But that said, again, Newcastle and also the Hoffenheim result in the cup. That was, from what I understand, I unfortunately didn't see the game, but I told that was a decent, solid performance. So they're a bit back and forth, and they are where they are. So, I guess the fact is that they need to be doing more and it isn't good enough. But at the same time, is it terrible? I don't know. Maybe a more objective opinion would be valuable at this point.
Well, I mean, if you look at the sort of online fandom at, Borussia Dortmund X, or formerly known as Twitter, you would think that Dortmund are less successful than some small-time criminal sitting at the Golgotha bar drinking pornos. Catch the literary reference here. But they are the second biggest club in terms of members in the Bundesliga, in terms of their finance. They are sort of in a sort of cluster now with RB and Bayer Leverkusen, you would assume. They can generate a lot of sponsorship money, more than these teams, in terms of, getting outside sponsors. But again, I mean, they are sort of competing for that second best spot, really. And, well, what you have to say is it's once again a transitional year for them, because once again, they've lost their key player. I mean, they've lost Sancho, Haaland, now Bellingham over the years. And losing this sort of, like, your best player every season or every second or third season, that in itself is also presenting a struggle to any coach and to any team, really. And you have to say, in terms of the transfers that Sebastian Kehl has pulled off this summer, there's room for criticism there as well. You know, I wouldn't just put it on Terzic. I don't want to be unkind, but, you know, why do you always get the Bayern rejects? Is one of the questions that Sebastian Kehl would have to answer in my book. Because, I mean, sure, Mats Hummels had a history at the club, but, you know, why did you have to get Sabitzer too? You know, wasn't there any sort of player yet that you managed to pull out of White Scout who had some sort of similar stats and characteristics that, you know, would have been slightly more exciting to sign than Sabitzer? I don't doubt that he's a great footballer, but is he the sort of guy who's actually a meaningful signing in terms of bringing you forward and you know, getting you to the next level.
I mean, I completely agree with you about Sabitzer. I mean, he's a fine player. But I'd ask myself, is he who we are looking for? I think we may have dredged over this a little bit last time out, Nick, you and I, so I will be brief on that point. But I think that there's a strong case to be said that I think that the decision to make Emre Can captain, I think, has come, and I'm not suggesting he's an unworthy captain, but because I think that the situation in the Dortmund midfield is quite fluid post-Bellingham, that I think that the coach needs to be a little bit more open-minded about who he picks in that midfield in view of who he's got there. And that maybe Can, the implication being if you're the captain, you're the first on the team sheet. I think that caused him some restrictions. I am puzzled that, for example, Sadio Özcan doesn't seem to get into the team more than I think he should. I think he's a quality player. I was very puzzled when El Yeshkiri went to Eintracht because I thought he was made to be a Dortmund black player. And I have to agree that I think, you know, 5-6 years ago, actually, do you know what? Probably longer, 10 years ago, when we were looking to replace Bellingham, they'd have found someone from the French league and brought them through, you know. But it doesn't look like that philosophy exists anymore.
But do you think that is sort of the marked difference between Zorc and Kehl then? Is sort of Kehl going for the more secure-looking choices of players who have already got Bundesliga experience?
Yeah, I might make the argument that maybe there's an overlap between Zorc and Kehl anyway, and so I don't think that gets Zorc off the hook. It's possible that Dortmund, because the scouting has changed, it's a lot more digital. It's the same deal with Monchi at Sevilla. Everyone said this guy was a genius, but really all he was doing is he was doing these scouting processes first. He was pioneering them. When everyone caught up with him, you know, his impact was lessened. And it's arguably maybe this is the same that's happened at Dortmund is that, you know, the other thing is with Dortmund is that if you've got a young kid in your under 19s and Dortmund come and have a look at them, then the price is going to go right up. So he must be good then because you're looking at him. So that can be a problem. I think if I may, I think the other issue I think is up front. I mean, I like Füllkrug. He's a very likable player. But the only reason I think he's really there is because Allaire has just not worked out this season, and that's very disappointing for any number of reasons. No doubt he's a quality player, but it's just he's had a difficult start to the season, and obviously you're really relying on him to be able to score those goals. So I think there's other aspects that maybe are slightly beyond the control of the club, I would say, that you can't necessarily legislate for. But yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, as someone who's literally written a history about Borussia Dortmund, I look at where they are and I still, yeah, I have. It's available in all good bookshops and in ebook format as well.
Oh, it's on Amazon as well. I think it was sort of like, it's in the top 100 of sports and leisures.
Top 100?
Or top 1,000.
Yeah, that's kind of throwing shade on my book. It is actually good, despite what Nick Wildhagen says. So given the entire history of Dortmund, I'd still say Dortmund are in a pretty good place, you know, emotionally. But I understand why a lot of fans, given, you know, the Dortmund world they were born into, would have, you know, higher expectations and should have higher expectations. So it is definitely disappointing.
All right. Let's, before we go, dig into a brief bit of a topic that I think we will probably continue in a special episode over the winter break. Watch out for that. That is the proliferation of investors, strategic partners, whatever you want to call them, in the Bundesliga, selling, you know, minority stakes to outside investors. I can think of at least one club that's been kind of a big deal. But Werder Bremen, Nick's own Werder Bremen, wants to join the ranks. What are these comments that are coming out from the old Geschäftsführer about their search for a little hot cash injection?
Well, what Werder Bremen basically saying is that we're in fierce competition in the Bundesliga. It's a dog-eat-dog world, and we need more cash. We are currently struggling to, you know, pay transfer sums above 5 million euros. We don't have, you know, any of that sweet, sweet cash that some of the other clubs have lying around. Obviously, Hertha doesn't seem to be a cautionary tale to them, what happened to all that Vintos cash. They think, you know, we need cash to sign bigger players, improve our infrastructure, but at the same time, we want an investor who is in keeping with our values, which is sort of like, yeah, that's what everybody says, really, before they get in some sort of questionable private entity into that club. I mean, you had Herter with, you know, Vintost, and who went on about, you know, turning this into a big city club because it should be. And Vintost then sold his shares to 777 and afterwards went on partying with Josh Wander, party boy from Miami, presumably. I'm not kidding. There's actually a photo on social media that shows the two of them partying long after Herter was sold to 777. And, well, 777, they sort of like, you know, just sort of pretty much typed into respect the 50+1 rule into ChatGPT, or whatever it's called. You know, the
GPT. GPT, my friend.
GPT, yeah.
You wouldn't know he's the youngest among us, would you?
No. I'm, you know,
come on, Granddad.
I'm an old soul.
He does have the bushiest mustache as well, which
I do. I mean, Mark Twain looked like a pubescent little shit compared to me.
Please come to the point, yeah. Sir. Come to the point, sir.
Well, I mean, the point is that they basically used that program to, you know, get a sort of statement on respecting, you know, tradition, 50+1 rule, all that sort of shit. And now look where they at. You know, I mean, you Matt, as a Herter fan, you must feel that they don't give a shit about your tradition, 50+1, or anything, really. Do you?
I don't, and I think as long as they don't overstep their bounds, which, as far as I can tell thus far, it hasn't happened, I actually don't care what their position on the 50+1 rule is, as long as the check's clear.
Well, Bill, there's a question about that as well, then.
I know, and we will get into that in our 777 special, but I did want to press you just for a moment about whether you think it is even realistic for Werder to find a strategic partner, and if they did find one, what would that do for them? I mean, there's just been so few positive examples of this working, other than, you know, the extremely well-controlled and sort of gradual example of Bayern, where, you know, their corporate sponsors have turned into investors, but that happened over a period of 20 years, and they only bought in because they saw it rightfully as a money machine.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between, I mean, Bayern basically is run like a well-run company. I mean, I think Simon Cooper and, what's his name, Stefan Szymanski, they argue in Soccernomics that Bayern, they've missed a trick in terms of them not winning more titles, international titles, because they've been so concerned about balancing their books. So what Simon Cooper and Stefan Szymanski are basically saying is that Bayern, you know, if they've not been like a normal company and, you know, been concerned about, you know, making a profit and paying out a dividend to their investors, they actually would have, you know, been able to buy bigger players, pay more higher wages, and win more titles. So Bayern are quite unique in a sense in terms of European football, because when you look at the Premier League sides, when you look at Ligue 1 sides like PSG, when you look at Italian teams, you know, like Juventus, which has always been sort of been owned by Fiat, they don't give a shit about balancing their books to a great extent. You know, there's certainly a lot of money there. So these teams are literally buying titles by running up massive debts at times. Can you do that in the Bundesliga? No, because there are much harsher regulations in terms of that. And any partner coming into that picture where they cannot get a majority stake, where they, you know, you end up with something like 777, about people who really don't seem like to know what they're doing. I mean, Hasan Ismaik, the guy who bought 1860 Munich, or thought he did, he wasn't aware of the 50+1 rule. And, you know, legend has it that he was actually thinking that he bought Bayern Munich. Which, yeah, says it all, really. But, I mean, you don't really get any serious investors taking interest in the Bundesliga because the 50+1 rule is there. And honestly, I don't see who would be interested in, you know, putting a lot of money into Bremen and then being told that, well, thanks for your money, we'll take it from here.
I don't think that it's possible, given how much money Bayern have, how far ahead they are in sporting sense, and given the financial restrictions and the ownership model of Bundesliga clubs, I don't believe it is possible for even the best-run football club to be able to catch up with Bayern Munich at this point. Because it's just not possible to raise enough money. And even if you couldn't afford to have a setback season. You couldn't afford to have a bad season. You'd have to be constantly growing in order to be able to catch up. And I just find it really very, very difficult to see any investor seriously going in for that, because I just think that they would look at it. And if they did think it was possible, then you'd have to question their judgment. And that would be reason enough for not getting them in.
I mean, one thing I could see happening is that Vertebrain has actually been, sort of last few years, they've actually made a concerted effort to grow the Vietnamese fan base. I mean, I've been to Vietnam once. That country is seriously football crazy. You can see football on television screens all around the country at all hours, really. Everything is shown. The people living there, they're taking a great interest in every football league, really. I mean, if it's not only the Bundesliga, but, you know, they care about everything. And so, I mean, if you could sort of have an angle there, maybe, I mean, of, you know, getting outside money from Asia might be a sort of like an option that the officials at Werder are looking at.
I'm intrigued by that. Definitely intrigued.
You know, I couldn't see any sort of German company or European company looking at Werder Bremen and thinking, yeah, that's where we'll park a couple of €100 million. Do what you want. You know, I just couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it happening. You know, I might be too negative on Werder Bremen's part here, but I mean, yes, with all of that history and all of that greatness, and it's not enough when you look at how the club has been run over the last 15 years.
Yeah, there's nothing to suggest that Werder would spend the money wisely, is there? Very little to suggest that Werder would spend the money wisely. So, yeah, it doesn't seem like anybody who was interested in investing would be doing so in good faith. And that would worry me, I think, a lot if I was a Werder fan, if I was in your shoes, Nick. It is disappointing because Werder are a great club that have, until fairly recently, been there or thereabouts, as they say. And now you look at them and think, well, gosh, I don't, they're going to need to have some kind of like crazy sort of like outlier season like Stuttgart are having, where, you know, in order to get up there, but, you know, can they stay there? We've just been talking about Union and about their amazing rise, but it looks like it might be coming crashing down. It's sustainable success at the top level. There's only three clubs, I think, who can probably reliably sustain that, or can reliably look to the future and say, yeah, this is where we'll be. And that's obviously Bayern Munich, and that's two of the three corporate clubs. So RB and Bayer Leverkusen. I think everybody else, you know, I mean, that is the thing I would caution Dortmund fans about, is, like, you know, we came from the bottom and we can go back there in a few seasons. It can turn that quickly, I think, even with a club as big as Dortmund. So I think it is a worry. And I think it's a worry broader for the Bundesliga, because I think, you know, the private equity funds have not, just because they didn't get their way earlier in the year, it doesn't mean they're not still sniffing around. They will be back with a new solution for private equity firms. So at some point there will be some short-term cash coming into the Bundesliga. And of course, Bremen, amongst all the other clubs, will benefit from that. But I would suggest that that will only serve to put the price of everything up. And of course, there'll be payback for it as well. There'll be changes that those investors will want to see as well. And that brings into question everything. So
what we do know about private equity is the fact it's basically a soulless driven machine that is only out for more cash for itself. I mean, the point of private equity is to give a little cash to get a lot of cash back.
I think the best thing about football clubs is that they shouldn't really be run for rampant profit. They should be run for the sake of themselves. And, you know, you conduct your sporting matters accordingly. And, you know, that's a naive perspective. We don't live in that world, and we haven't done for a very long time. But it is sort of depressing to sort of see, you know, 50+1, I think, increasingly being challenged by owners who I suspect are just fed up of being poor and fed up of buying, winning everything.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not going to change, really. It's not going to change because even the corporate clubs are not able to raise the kind of cash that Bayern are.
No.
And, you know, they are even trying a couple of tricks here and there. I mean, the other week, a few weeks ago, we talked about the fact that Wolfsburg are actually the team that actually has the best shirt sponsorship deal, and the Wolfsburg are, of course, sponsored by Volkswagen, who are also their owner. So, I mean, they are even to try, you know, pulling off those tricks, and even still Bayern outraises them quite handily, really.
All right, that is all for this edition of Talking Fußball. Really good to be back on with you two. Thanks for filling in my absence last time. First of all, to you, Nick.
Well, always a pleasure, and yeah, it was... it was fun chatting to you once again.
Nice. Thank you. Thank you. Great to have you here, Terry.
Great to be here. Thanks very much for having me on. And looking forward to speaking again 2 weeks hence.
Beautiful. All right. Many thanks also to our producer, Aiden Rantoul. And, you know, I got to say this. Bis zum nächsten Mal, y'all.